Chapter 16. Chimpanzees nearly always eat meat slowly, usually chewing leaves with each new mouthful, as though to savor the taste for as long as possible. Often, too, I saw them actually licking the branches of the tree where the kill had touched them, or where drops of blood presumably had fallen. Jane Goodall, In the Shadow of Man.
Journal entry number 13 continued. No one spoke, all of us probably wondering if we'd really heard it, but then, a moment later, crying. Human. As a group, we dropped everything and rushed out into the night. It was clear. Close to the village, maybe halfway up the ridge in a densely wooded clump above the Booth's house. A lone voice. Piercing. Agony. Like when you're little, the sound you first hear from a friend who's fallen hard. That long rush of diaphragm torment after the initial shocked inhale. Vincent? Bobby's voice, wobbly, questioning. Then she hollered right next to me, Vincent! Effie covered Palomino's ears, leading her back inside as Vincent's next long shriek broke into echoing sobs. Bobby looked at me. Why me? He's hurt. Then to Dan. We have to go get him. Dan stepped toward the sound. Just one step, because Mostar reached out to grab his arm. She missed, but held him firmly by a clump of shirt. No. Her expression was blank. Practical. Don't. More distant sobs. Quick, soft, then suddenly launching into another long scream. He's hurt! Bobby looked incredulously at Mostar, then to Dan. He needs help! I saw Dan wiggle his arm slightly, pulling at Mostar's grip. Testing? She wouldn't budge. That's what they want. It took me a second to realize what she meant. I suddenly wanted to throw up everything I'd just eaten. Dan got it. I saw his shoulders sag. Carmen and Reinhardt, too. Not the shoulders, but the understanding. A moment of surprise, then a mental shift. Carmen facing back out to the ridge with Reinhardt studying his shoes. But Bobby. They? She threw her hands up. What they? You can't hear them! Can't you smell them? Asked Mostar. Even with the wind at our backs, the stench was overpowering. They're keeping quiet on purpose. Mostar kept her attention on the ridge. They want to draw us out, pull us apart. The way her eyes squinted, flicking from side to side. Sniper trick. What? Bobby started to say, then, as if she'd just picked the winning lottery ticket, her whole face broke into this wide smile. You're crazy! Shaking her head with this little half-chuckling gasp. Crazy! Son of a bitch! Post-trauma! And then she spun back to the darkness. Vincent! We're coming, baby! We're coming! And over at Dan with a head jerking, come on! And when he didn't move. What's the matter with you? Her eyes focused on him, then out to the wider group. Dan, just standing there, believing Mostar but wanting to help Bobby so badly. The way his eyebrows narrowed, lip quivering. I would have said something, I know I would have, but then I noticed his face. The light thrown on his skin, just the barest shade brighter. And behind him, Carmen shouted, There! She was pointing past us to the space between the Booth and Durant houses. None of us had noticed it until then. We didn't realize that the lower half of that space had been partially blocked by something. And that something was now running up the slope behind the houses. The one with long legs. Scout. Watching us all this time? Frustrated when we wouldn't take the bait? I watched him vanish into the brambles, just below a gap in the trees. And in that gap, at the top of the ridge, lit by the glow of the houses. I can't be sure if it was Alpha. You can't tell at that distance. And I'm not sure of what I think it was waving at us. It had to be a branch, and it must have been cracked in the middle. Why else would it have dangled like that? And there's no way, no way I could have seen what my brain keeps telling me were fingers. We can't. Reinhardt, speaking to the back of my head. Then, as I turned to the group, Mostar's right. We can't go out there. And to Bobby, I'm sorry. Sorry. In the pale motion light glare, I watched her lips go white. Bobby, Reinhardt gave a resigned shrug. Please, just look at the situation with... Another scream, and Bobby pointed to the darkness. Listen! Eyes wet, bouncing slightly like a child. At the next scream, she grabbed her hair with both hands. Oh my God! Oh my God! Dan tried another quick lunge away from Mostar, his free arm reaching behind his back for the stabber he'd hidden under his shirt. She must have seen the bulge, or just suspected. Dan! Her voice raised in warning. Her other arm grabbed his. Bobby looked at both of them, hands out, rasping, please. Carmen edged toward her. I followed. I don't know what we thought we would do. Comfort? Restrain? Carmen barely touched her shoulder before she threw it off in a wild, frantic swipe. Please, please, to all of us, please. Bobby, said Reinhardt, soft and soothing. You have to understand that there's nothing we can... You! She growled, turning on him. You're doing this! Then the howling began. Vincent's pain drowned in a bellowing chorus. Like a starting gun, that's how I think of it now, because the sound seemed to launch Bobby at Reinhardt. She caught him mid-turn. I could see where her nails scratched his ear. He reached up to grab the wound, just as Carmen and I reached out to hold her back. You told him it was okay! You let him go! Thrashing like a hooked fish. You're letting him die! My mind flashed back to Vincent's departure. Did he confer with Reinhardt before leaving? Ask his advice? Is that why Reinhardt had been so generous with the ice cream? Guilt? Bobby, just think... Reinhardt, hands out, palms open, lip quivering, steam rising from his glistening forehead. Think. You! Bobby screeched, kicking up, out, barely missing his face. You! What do you want? I jumped at the bass, the sheer volume of Reinhardt's voice. What do you want from us? He smashed his hands against his face, frantically rubbing like he was trying to wipe off reality. They'll kill us, Bobby! His hands out, clawing the air in front of her, punctuating each word. They will kill us all! Instinctively, I pulled Bobby back. I thought he was going to hit her the way he came at her like that. But he wasn't coming at her. His face. Shock. His knees hit the ground, hands out, mouth open. Carmen yelled, "Grab him!" Reinhardt keeled forward just as Mostar and Dan caught him under the arms. I let go of Bobby, jumped over to help Mostar. God, he was so heavy. Hot. Damp. We can't. Wheezing. Can't. Mostar kept calling his name. Alex. Alex, look at me. Can you hear me? Slack-jawed, glass-eyed, drool dripping from his bottom lip. Are you taking something? Mostar grabbed his jaw, turning his face into hers. Medication. Do you have pills at your house? Alex? Listen to me, Alex! Thump. The first stone landed right next to us, throwing a cloud of dust in our faces. Thump. 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 Get inside, Mostar grunted, struggling to lift Reinhardt. In the common house! As we pulled him through the door, Effie and Pal slammed it behind us. Mostar barked, Lights! The room went dark as we guided Reinhardt to the couch. He oofed into the cushions, hands on chest, rasping. Mostar ran to the sink, shouting, Everyone down! Away from the windows! China clinking, rocks hitting the roof, Bobby's soft sobs. Reinhardt's defiant, Mmm! As he pushed at the water Mostar'd gotten. All of it in half light, all to the soundtrack of distant wails. Mostar gave the water one more try. Reinhardt shoved so violently it spilled on me, then he leaned to the side, gagging. Mostar crawled for the trash bin. Reinhardt retched, gagged, spat on the floor. Mostar got the can under him just in time. I turned away as the room filled with vomit stink. Reinhardt groaned, spat again, croaked something like, Can't! Can't! Hold his head. Mostar took my hand and cupped his slippery forehead with it. As he dry-heaved again, she went back to the sink to moisten a dishcloth. He was mumbling by that point, words and groans strung together. I felt so sorry for him, so helpless. He was suffering right there, and there was nothing I could do. That helplessness. Vincent, Bobby, feeling so powerless, victimized. I'm not sure when my sympathy turned. Maybe when the pleading started. High, meek. Want to go home. That phrase, again and again. Want to go home. Punctuated with tiny infantile whimpers. Once he said someone's name. Hannah. I think right before. Home. I want. Die. I tried not to think it. Feel it. Die. Just die. Biting my lip, glaring at him in the darkness. Please just shut up and fucking die. That was 6 hours ago. 5 hours since the rocks finally stopped. Mostar made us wait an hour, sitting there in silence, ensuring it was safe to move. Reinhardt was asleep by then, or catatonic, we can't be sure. It took four of us to get him safely home. He's on his living room sofa now, his breathing is steady. Carmen is watching him. We still don't know if he actually had a heart attack. Effie thinks it might be something called stress cardiomyopathy, a panic attack that mirrors cardiac arrest. Effie's not sure, though. She reminded us that she and Carmen are psychologists, not psychiatrists. But even if they had gone to medical school, would that solve anything? Without the right drugs and equipment? Siri, how do you treat a heart attack in your own home? We agreed to at least watch him in shifts. If he doesn't wake up, we'll have to think about how to take care of him. Needs like feeding and, yes, going to the bathroom. We'll all have to pitch in. And everyone has. Mostar's our leader now. And everyone who can is working to build her defensive perimeter. Effie and Pal are home cutting bamboo stalks into stakes. Mostar and Dan are outside collecting more. I can see them clearly just across the driveway, crouching in the outside lights, rhythmically moving to the flash of their bread knives. Mostar doesn't want anyone outside alone, not while it's still dark. Just in case they get bold enough to try. Try what? She thinks we'll be safe in daylight, especially within the confines of the village. That should give us enough time to finish the perimeter. A couple days, maybe. One more night. She doesn't think they'll work up the nerve for a home invasion. That's what she told me once we got Reinhardt home. And besides, why did she have to add this part? Their bellies are full for now. Vincent. Bobby. She cried herself to sleep just now, curled up with her head in my lap. I can see why she said it. We'll find him. Dawn. We'll look for him. Find him. We will. Denial. Hope. Xanax. It's obvious why she wants to search for him. But why did I agree to help? I guess that's obvious, too. I need to do something to make up for what I thought about Reinhardt. That's not me. Won't be. A quick nap now. Set my phone alarm for sunup. At least it's still good for something. So am I. Who thinks thoughts like that? Who am I?
From my interview with Senior Ranger Josephine Schell.
Have you ever seen chimps hunt monkeys? They form a tight team. Every member has a job. You have the flushers, climbing the trees, shaking the branches, screaming bloody murder to scare the smaller primates into running for their lives. Terror is a powerful weapon. Terror clouds thought. The flushers are counting on that. Intelligence surrendering to self-preservation. If they can get just one to break away from the group, that's key. There's strength in numbers, even for prey. Children are the most vulnerable, the easiest to isolate. But even a full-grown adult can be rattled enough to slip up. Fear-soaked brain switched off. Running, climbing, jumping, hopefully right into the arms of the other chimps lying in wait. If the monkey's lucky, it'll die quickly, a twist of the neck, or having its head swung into a tree. If not, I've seen a red colobus trying to pull itself away, shrieking for its life while the chimp holds it down with one hand and rips its guts out with the other. The only term I can think of is bloodlust, because that's what it sounds like when chimps tear a monkey apart. It's not like any other kill you'd ever see. Not like when a leopard brings down a gazelle, or even sharks rip into a seal. Those are cold, mechanical. Apes go crazy, hopping and dancing. Don't tell me they don't enjoy it. And don't tell me that the hunt only exists for pure sustenance. They pass out that meat according to rank. The leader standing over the corpse as the others wait, literally with their hands out. They treat it like currency. The same social order which allows that kind of disciplined, coordinated attack is maintained by the attack's bloody spoils.
Chapter 17. At first, Bauman could see nobody, nor did he receive an answer to his call. Stepping forward, he again shouted, and as he did so, his eye fell on the body of his friend, stretched beside the trunk of a great fallen spruce. Rushing towards it, the horrified trapper found the body was still warm, but that the neck was broken, while there were four great fang marks in the throat. The footprints of the unknown beast creature, printed deep in the soft soil, told the whole story. The unfortunate man, having finished his packing, had sat down on the spruce log with his face to the fire and his back to the dense woods to wait for his companion. While thus waiting, his monstrous assailant, which must have been lurking nearby in the woods, waiting for a chance to catch one of the adventurers unprepared, came silently up from behind, walking with long, noiseless steps and seemingly still on two legs. Evidently unheard, it reached the man and broke his neck by wrenching his head back with its forepaws, while it buried its teeth in his throat. It had not eaten the body, but apparently had romped and gambled round it in uncouth, ferocious glee, occasionally rolling over and over it, and had then fled back into the soundless depths of the woods. President Theodore Roosevelt, The Wilderness Hunter.
Journal entry number 14, October 13th. It was irresponsible what I did. Selfish and stupid. I knew it was wrong. Otherwise, I would have told someone. Bobby was asleep. Reinhardt, too, probably, with Effie watching him. I'd seen her take over for Carmen, who'd gone back to cutting more steaks with Pal. I figured Dan and Mostar were doing the same thing. No one saw me slip out of the Booth's house, and I managed to get a quarter of the way up the trail before hearing, "Wait!" Dan was coming up behind me, spear in one hand, javelin in the other. He was using them like hiking poles, pushing himself at twice my speed. His red face, that clenched-jawed determination. I turned to face him, ready for the fight. "No, Dan, no, you can't stop me. I'm going to find Vincent, and there's nothing you can do about it. And there never was. You're done holding me back, and I'm done babying you. No, no, keep your mouth shut. Here's what's going to happen. I'm going out to find Vincent while you turn your ass around and make yourself useful until I get back." Wouldn't that have made a great speech? It was already in my head, probably stored in one form or another for years. But it never got a chance to be said, because just as I raised my hand to stop him, Dan gave that open hand the javelin and trudged right on by. I gawked at his back for a moment before he twisted to offer his free hand. And that's how we traveled, hand in hand, mutually supportive, hiking up the trail the way I'd dreamed about since day one. Figures. We didn't hear anything, didn't see any movement. I couldn't help but hope that maybe they really were nocturnal, blissfully asleep, full. We made it halfway up before intersecting with the footprints, the tracks from last night, Scout drawing a straight line from the houses to the top of the ridge. That was where the other one, Alpha, maybe, had been standing. She'd left a mess of prints there, and blood, beaded in the ash, spattered on the trees. More red flecks led us down the opposite slope. It was slow going. There's no trail there, not a natural one. She'd torn through the foliage, leaving a path of bloody, broken branches. Those breaks, jabbing our sides with each misstep. The ground was soft there, spongy. No visibility, and no sound except for my own heartbeat. The path curved around a large pine, which we now realized had been concealing a small clearing. Bones, fragments, they were everywhere, mixing with ash and mud. Too many for just one animal, with bits of fur and severed hooves. The deer we'd seen, and maybe some more we hadn't. I recognized the few bloody stones, the type used for butchering. But these new piles, each was about a foot high and twice as wide. Each stone looked pristine and roughly as large as the kind they'd thrown at us. Stockpiles for the next bombardment? If they're smart enough to plan ahead like this, then what else are they capable of? As we walked slowly among the stones and bones, I began to pick out distinct islands. Leaves, moss, whole ferns torn up by the roots, all pressed into the earth and all of it mixed with the long, coarse fibers I now recognized as hairs. Sleeping mats? The stench worse than ever. Different. Dan tugged my hand, drawing my attention to several small, brown mounds at the edge of the trees. Feces? What do you call this place? A nest? A lair? Dan lowered his hand to something just below the nearest mound, a long, thin object that shone in the overcast light. We didn't need to get any closer. It was one of Vincent's hiking poles. That was when the trees in front of us moved. He was big, maybe the first one I'd seen. That night at the kitchen door, he was broad, muscular, but missing Alpha's scars. His eyes flicked between the two of us, his growl low. Languishing. Dan was the first to retreat, rising slowly, gently pulling me back. The large male lowered his head, growled again, and took a cautious step toward us as the woods around him suddenly came alive. They'd been right there the whole time. All of them. I close my eyes now, trying to picture each one, and maybe it's silly to assign names, but that's where my mind naturally goes. The two smaller, younger brothers from the compost bin fight, twins one and two, flanking their, what, father? The first male, Alpha's mate? What's that term for Philip in the crown? Prince consort? And there was thin, tall Scout to his right, with the older male, Gray, between him and the old female, Granny Dowager, at the end. On the left, she was young and adolescent, I think. She'd been the one I'd seen running through the brush, the one with lighter reddish fur. It seemed to flow around her, soft, shining, princess. And on her left, another female, older, bigger, still with patches of soft red fur, but a distended belly that she cradled in one arm. Pregnant? Juno. And the young male to her left, at first I thought he wasn't even a male. They hadn't dropped yet, barely hanging from the fur between his legs. Everything about him was young. His frenetic hopping, his high chattering, his constant rapid glances over his shoulder. Waiting, calling for the three shapes looming up behind consort. Two females, one old, one young, both holding fur balls in their arms. Babies. Two mothers, hunched, hesitant, following behind her. Alpha. The whole troop seemed to part when she approached, even consort, who stared at the ground when she passed him. No growls from her, no chatter, silently approaching to match our slow retreat up the slope out of the clearing back toward the top of the ridge. Monkeys. That's the image I can't get out of my head, the little monkeys at the zoo with their wide, darting eyes. That was us, trying to look everywhere at once. Forward to the advancing troop, down to the stone piles at our feet, side to side at the gradually enveloping ring, and back to the open, narrowing escape. They were trying to surround us, cut us off. That must have been what prompted Dan to speed up. I felt his grip constrict my wrist, the pulling as I locked eyes on Alpha, her lips curled back, jaw fell. The roar. I felt the warmth, the stink. It sent the troop into a frenzy, jumping, dancing, throwing their arms up amidst those piercing shrieks. I didn't think about what I was doing, just raised my arm as she reached one face-sized hand toward us. I don't know if the javelin's blade cut her deeply or if it just bent around her closing fingers. The grip, that vicious hard tug, I can still feel the rug-burn friction on my skin as she ripped it out of my hand, then tossed it, spinning above our heads. That was when Dan turned, brandishing his spear, jabbing the air, poking harmlessly. She didn't care. She avoided the thrust with quick bobs of that neckless head. She even tried to grab it, swooping her arms, forcing Dan back. That new sound, short barks, was she laughing? I looked behind us, saw the ring close, then back to Alpha, who finally got a hold of Dan's spear. I see it now in slow motion. One hand on the spear, the other, a fist, raised high, mouth open as the huge face leaned in. Glowing eyes, two flickering beads, not a hallucination. They were burning, reflecting. Back! She released the spear, recoiling sharply just as the flames passed between myself and Dan. Get back! Mostar barreling in between us, brandishing a fireball-tipped pole. Go Nita Se'u Pichku Matarinu. Her language and theirs. Foreign words mixed with guttural animal noises. She snarled. She barked. She spat a high, hissing roar as the troop retreated amid jerky, frightened yelps. Frightened. Even Alpha. Reticent, arms down, shoulders up, head bobbing for an opening amid soft, clucking calls. Mostar clucked back, a sound like, "Mersh! Mersh!" Then, "Pichko Yedna!" As she lunged forward, backing off Alpha, swinging her torch that I now saw as a burning towel wrapped in electrical wire. I could also see that it was starting to burn out, flames giving way to smoke. "Yebum Leeti Curve!" Mostar barked as she hurled the torch up and to the retreating Alpha, then to us, "Run!" The ring had opened, the slope was clear. Dan and I ran, stumbling up the muddy ground. "Mostar!" Dan called. I looked. She was right behind us, waving, "Run!" And here they came, loping side to side, still cautious, wondering if we had more fire. Alpha standing her ground, stooping to pick something up. I turned to watch where I was going just as the first rock smashed into the tree next to me. The maze, obstructing a clear getaway, but also a clear shot. The crack of rocks, hitting branches, bonking against path-blocking trunks. A slurping thump of a stone cantaloupe buried in the mud right in front of me. "Zig!" Mostar behind us, shouting what I first thought was a foreign word. "Zigzag!" she shouted, then oof from a hit. A glancing blow I found out later like the one that hit Dan. I saw that one. A low angle grazing his shoulder, but with enough force to spin. Dan pivoted, tripped. I caught his fall, forcing him up, pulling him the last few feet. We could see the top of the ridge, up and over, just a few more steps. The moment I could see the village, the downward slope. Relief. I remember that rush. Then the impact. The blow between my shoulder blades. Winded, falling forward. Dan's turn to catch me now, and Mostar pushing us both. "Don't stop! Don't stop!" Racing down the slope, trying not to slip, trying not to notice, to recognize the object that had hit me. It was still rolling down the incline in front of us. Black and brown, hair and face, Vincent Booth's head. Down to the closest house, the Perkins Foresters, kitchen door open, arms beckoning Carmen and Pal. "Come on, come on!" In and through, crouching on the kitchen floor behind the counter, dizzy, lungs burning, small arms gripping my sides, a warm face pressed up against my stomach. Opening my eyes down onto the top of Pal's head, then over to Dan, gripping his spear, waiting. They didn't come, not even close. They didn't even bombard the house, just wailed at us from the distance. "Fire," Mostar huffing with closed eyes. "They're still afraid of it." "Can we make bonfires?" Carmen asked, glancing over the counter at the door. Surround the village? Nothing. To burn. Mostar, pulling herself up, holding on to the counter for support. Too wet. The trees. Another deep breath, fighting for control. Maybe. We have some more time. Finish the stakes before they get over the shock. And we can make torches, too, if we need them. More weapons. My head was clearing by then, the adrenaline draining. I shifted slightly, signaling Pal to step back. Grabbing my hand, we got up together, her eyes looking up into mine. I'm okay, stroking her hair. It's okay. Then over to Mostar, who was still fixed on the door. I reached out to touch her shoulder, a gentle rub. Thank you. And when she turned, a hard slap, loud, knocking me sideways. What were you thinking? Grabbing my cheek, facing her glare. Were you thinking? Before I could answer, either one of you? And another hard slap, this one up to Dan's chin. Children. Dan, white, shaking. We silenced him with a finger. You. Help finish the stakes. The finger swung toward Carmen and Pal. Stay with them. Stay together. I flinched as she faced me, turning to protect my swelling cheek. And you. You come with me. Now. I followed Mostar to the kitchen door, pausing while she checked the quiet ridge. It was empty now. They'd pulled back to the other side. Mostar moved her head slowly from the edge of the Perkins Forster's yard to the booths. It took me a second to realize what she was looking for. Vincent's head was lying at the bottom of the slope, within the moat-like depression around one of the apple trees. He was staring right at us, eyes and mouth wide open. Frozen in time? His last expression? Fear? Regret? Was he thinking about Bobby or his childhood? Was he cursing himself for making such a horrible decision the way I cursed myself for mine? That face. Will I ever forget? With enough time and therapy, hypnosis, or a drug I've never heard of? Is there something to help me unsee? But Mostar, she didn't seem to mind at all, picking it up like a basketball a kid had accidentally thrown over her fence. She crouched on her knees to grab it, tucked it under her arm, then gave me a quick glance just to make sure I was still in tow. We ambled straight into the kitchen. Nonchalant. Inhuman. She reached under the sink, took out a white plastic garbage bag, dropped the head inside. Then, after washing her hands, she opened the freezer and rolled it inside. Don't tell Bobby. Covering his head with ice. She knows he's gone. She doesn't need to know about this. Here. She held up an ice pack from the freezer door, pressing it to my cheek, waiting for me to take it. When I did, she raised her eyes to within inches of mine. Are you here? Her voice was softer now. Her face. I didn't intend to sob, it just escaped quickly like a cough. Her eyes hardened. I need you here. Are you here? I straightened, nodded. You need to focus on what I'm about to teach you. Her hand, still on my face. Because what you did today was selfish and irresponsible. And stupid. Because you went out there without a proper weapon.
Chapter 18. Arudu bi chalimat alechi tameti min shari ma chalach. I seek refuge in the perfect words of Allah, from the evil of that which He has created. Sahih Muslim, Hadith 2708.
Journal entry number 14, continued. Mostar released my cheek, took my hand, and led me into her workshop, her armory. That's what it looked like now. Bamboo staffs against the wall, kitchen knives out on the workbench. Failed experiments. Prototypes were cast in the far corner. I could see unevenly sawed or split shafts, bent and chipped knives, snapped shoelaces, different rolls of tape, and an unspooled tangle of shiny red Christmas ribbon. Stand here, Mostar directed me to the middle of the room, back straight. She stared me up and down for a second, then reached for one of the bamboo poles. Stay still. She placed the stock against my back. Almost perfect. Then set the stock on the bench. Watch. Listen. Remember each step exactly. That's why I've written the next section down as a kind of instruction manual. I don't trust I'll remember anything after I pass out tonight. I'm also stuck on something Mostar said while we worked. Something about teaching the rest of the village. I didn't ask what she meant. I didn't get the chance. She just jumped right into the lesson, and here it is. How to make a spear from scratch. Choosing the right bamboo staff is critical. It can't be tapered. That'll ruin the balance. And it's got to fit your height. Too long is too unwieldy. Too short, and you risk falling on the blade. It doesn't have to be exact. More important that the top section perfectly encases the knife's handle. The staff's got to have the right girth, thick enough to be strong, but not so wide that you can't get a firm grip. Wow, that sounds dirty. Sorry, I'm really loopy right now. When harvesting the stalk, you saw just below the bottom connector, or whatever those rings are called. It takes a while, especially with a skinny bread knife. And there's a special method. If you go down one side, like with regular wood, and miss just a tiny bit of connecting fiber, that fiber will tear a strip down the whole length. As Mostar warns, that will decrease integrity and increase splinters. The trick is to first saw in a complete circle, severing that tough top layer before going for the deep cut. Next, you saw off all the branches, which can be made into stakes, and file down the sharp nubs with an emery board. Oh, for just one square of sandpaper. I didn't actually do these first two parts. That's why she'd measured me. A pre-cut stock would save time. That was the only part of the lesson she did herself. The rest was hands-on for me. Like the shaft, choosing the knife takes careful consideration. You can't just use the longest blade. Those tend to be too thin. The best option is the shorter, 8-inch chef type, which also needs to be the right design. One solid piece, the steel going all the way down through the handle. Otherwise, you can't attach it to the shaft, and attaching is the trickiest part. If the knife's grip is held in place by pins, you're in business. Pins mean holes in the steel, and those holes are the best way to tie them on, but I'll explain that part in a minute. Hopefully the grip itself is made of resin. That way you can smash it out with a rock. I know, not one hammer in the whole village. Be safe while smashing. Those fragments can hit you in the eye. While wearing Mostar's onion goggles, I felt little chips peppering my face. Once the grip and the pins are removed, the next step is fitting. Slide the handle into the hollow top of the shaft. If it doesn't fit, good, strong bamboo might not have enough internal room. You've got to saw out a little groove with the bread knife. Once your naked blade fits snugly, take it right back out for measuring. That's where the handle holes come in. Place those holes against the outside of the shaft, mark them with a pen, Sharpie if you got one, then do it again on the other side. See where I'm going with this? You bore those holes out with a paring knife. Take your time. Don't rush. Mostar showed me where she chipped off the edge of a couple of paring knives, ruining them forever. Checking for light shows if they all line up. I got it right the first time, and Mostar seemed impressed. Apparently, that's the easiest way to screw up, not matching the holes. And the more you drill, the more you weaken the bamboo. Next, you sew the knife in, and that's what the wire's for. Mostar used a 5-foot section of electrical cord from a floor lamp. After cutting the cord free, a regular scissors will do, pull the two sections apart, if it's that kind. Set the extra section aside for another spear and start threading the wire through the top hole. Sounds simple enough, but my first few tries only produced frustration. The tip kept getting stuck because I'd impatiently skipped a step. Shaving down the wire's end rubber to a point turns it into a needle, which makes a world of difference. Once the wire exits the second top pull, pull it through nearly to the end and tie the last inch or so into a secure knot. Then wrap the cord tightly round and round the bamboo until you get to the two bottom holes. Then thread it through, tie it off, and you're done. A real spear. Mostar took the weapon from me, held it in her hands, checking the balance, squinted with one eye at the knotted wire, then handed it back. "Well done, Katie." It was the first time she smiled all day. I felt so proud. For a minute, I just handled my creation. Vertical, horizontal. I even gave a short, thrusting motion with both hands and accidentally banged the back end into the garage door. Sorry. I felt my cheeks redden at the dent. Mostar waved it away with, "Forget it." Then, "I knew you'd be a natural at this. You have a logical, methodical mind. Much more than me." She gestured to the aborted prototypes. "This is how it works. Try, fail, learn, then pass on eventual success for improvement." That sparked my own idea for an improvement. What about melting the rubber? Won't it hold the blade even more securely? It might. Mostar gave me that nod an encouraging teacher gives a well-meaning but totally wrong first grader. But it would ruin the wire, which we might need to make more spears. She gestured to a collection of shorter, thinner shafts. "That's what worries me about the javelins, losing a good knife every time we throw one. Although I guess they'll just slide right out if I don't figure out a way to make barbs." Another idea stirred, but this one was far more nebulous. I looked at the 3D printer but couldn't manage a cohesive thought. Instead, I ended up yawning, which gave me a sympathy yawn from Mostar. "You need to sleep." She glanced up at the wall clock. "When you take over watching Reinhardt, I don't think he's woken up yet. You'll rest then. And eat." Eat. I suddenly felt sick to my stomach. I'd been so wrapped up in making the spear, so engrossed in the step-by-step process. But with some of my focus freed, I must have glanced over to the door, the kitchen, Vincent's head in the freezer. "We'll bury him later. Mostar, the mind reader. When we're safe. When we have time." I felt my head swim, lurching for the table. "Take a breath." Mostar took my spear, guiding me to the workbench's little stool. "Try to relax." I did, closing my eyes tightly. I felt the dam bursting in my brain. To be someone else's food. You're a person. You think. You feel. And then it's all gone, and what used to be you is now a mushy mess in something else's stomach. Carnage, blood, smiling yellow fangs, gnawing flesh, licking bones. "Look at me," the hand on my chin, forcing me to open my eyes. "I know." Mostar's sad smile, the sigh. "It's a blessing and a curse, the human mind. We're the only creatures on Earth that can imagine our own death. But," she held up my spear, "we can also imagine ways to prevent it." That was when the doorbell rang. Palomino stood in the entry, holding a rolled-up yoga mat. "What are you doing here, little doll?" Mostar grabbed her and pulled her inside. "You know you're not supposed to be outside all alone. Do your parents know where you are?" She shook her head, then pointed, with the mat, to something outside. Then I got it. The mat was to keep her knees clear of dirt. "Hey, pal, I'm sorry, I don't have time to garden with you right now. I've got to get over to Mr. Reinhardt to..." "Wrong." Pal shook her head at me, then shifted back to Mostar with a second gesture to... "What?" I looked but couldn't see anything. Not a specific house, not the volcano, and... thank God, no dark forms staring down from the trees. She was facing southeast, and, to my knowledge, there was nothing in that direction. Again, Mostar seemed perplexed. "I'm sorry, I don't..." Then, "Oh," followed by a quick glance back at her wall clock. "Oh." This big, broad smile broke her mouth wide open, and I'm pretty sure the corners of her eyes began to sparkle. "Oh, Lutko moya. It's been a long time." Mostar pinched the bridge of her nose, used it to shake her head, then looked up with a shrugging. "Come on. Let's see if I remember." Ignoring my confusion, Mostar put an arm around the girl and asked me, Would you mind running upstairs to fetch a clean towel from the hall closet? It was my first time upstairs. I didn't intend to snoop, but her house is laid out pretty much like ours. The hall closet is right next to the master bedroom. I didn't go in. The door was open. And the picture was so big, facing the bed, which you couldn't miss from my position in the hall. Mostar looked a lot younger, maybe 20s or 30s. She wasn't thin, but her hourglass figure stood out in her belted coat. Her hair glistened, raven black under a knit wool cap. The man with his arm around her, he looked about the same age. Goatee, glasses, the kind of Euro intellectual you always see in movies, the kind of guy I thought I'd marry when I was in high school. They both had their arms around the kids standing in front of them, boy and girl. The boy looked about 12, the girl maybe 10. Big grins, genuine on the boy, silly mugging on the girl. They were standing on the rocky bank of a frozen river. A bridge rose up behind them, narrow, no cars, an old stone arch connecting two sides of an equally old stone town. I didn't recognize the bridge at first, but then it hit me that I was looking at the real version of her glass sculpture. I couldn't tell where. Maybe Russia. I've only seen pictures of Red Square. I'm also pretty sure it wasn't Northwest Europe either. The buildings and the clothes seemed too drab, if that's the right word. Eastern Europe? Poland? Czech Republic? Or, if I remember high school history back then, it would have been Czechoslovakia? What's the southeast called? The part before you get to Turkey. Sounds like Baltics. Balkans. Yugoslavia, another country I'd read about in school. A war in the 90s? I would have been about those kids' age. I didn't exactly follow current events back then. The 90s were OJ and Britney. Even at Penn, I only took intro to poli-sci, and all I remember is the term ethnic cleansing. And Professor Tongan from Sudan. Like a tree in the forest, America doesn't hear foreign suffering. Shelling, snipers, siege fries, Mostar. Katie, from downstairs, we're waiting. I grabbed the biggest bath towel she had, ran downstairs, and found them in the kitchen. Mostar looked up at me, smirking. She has to know that I saw the picture. All she said was, perfect timing. They must have just finished washing their hands and, I think, their feet as well. I could see moisture glistening between their toes. I thought Mostar was going to use the towel to dry them off, but when she took it from me, the two of them headed into the living room. You can watch, she said over her shoulder. I don't think he'll mind. Or she. What do I know? She gave a slight shrug, chuckled, then spread the towel on the floor next to Pal's yoga mat. They were at an angle from the living room window, facing in the direction Pal had motioned to earlier. They both stood ramrod straight, placed their hands up a little past their shoulders, palms out, as Mostar chanted, Allahu Akbar. I won't try to describe in detail what I witnessed. I know I'd just mess it up. I want to be respectful, although I'm sure neither Mostar nor Pal would mind. The beauty of their prayer. The fluid ballet motions, raised arms, turned heads, knees bending and rising to Mostar's sung phrases. And then the name, through a cracking voice, Vincent Ernest Booth.
Chapter 19. It is from the farming class that the bravest men and the sturdiest soldiers come. Marcus Porcius Cato.
Journal entry number 14, continued. Leaving Mostar's house, I turned left instead of right. I wasn't supposed to be at Reinhardt's for another few minutes, and I wanted to spend that time in the garden. Not that there'd be much to do. I figured I'd turn on the drip line, maybe shower and change while it ran. I opened the front door, then the garage door, and gasped. Sprouts! A tiny little arch was poking up near my feet, right at the spot where I'd planted the first large white bean. Pal, I called, then sticking my head out the front door, shouted, Palomino, the garden is sprouting. I bent down to examine the little upside-down U. It was whitish, about half an inch high, and as I peered closer, I could see that tip of the bean below one end. The spot next to this arch looked like it was bulging a little, so, using Bobby's teapot, I dripped a few drops on it. Sure enough, as the dirt fell away, the first hint of an arch as well. I tried it again with the next one, and the one after that. So many ewes struggling to free themselves from the soil. And they weren't the only ones. The entire garden. Every inch. Oh my God! That was Carmen, who'd just come in with Pal. Did you plant all those? Just these, I said, referring to the marked beans. Ironically, nothing was coming up where I'd planted the Chinese peas and sweet potatoes. Or maybe they just weren't coming up yet. And it really didn't matter because their seed beds were surrounded by mysterious little shoots. They were everywhere, those shoots, scattered randomly across the entire garden. What are they all? Asked Carmen as Pal examined them on hands and knees. No idea, I said. I don't even know where they're coming from. Maybe the earth we brought in? That was Mostar, who'd just joined us. Maybe, I said with a little disappointment. If they were all just wild weeds. Compost? That was Dan. This was turning into a real party. The compost we mixed in, the older stuff at the bottom of the bins that turned into soil. Could there still be old seeds from... Cucumber slices? Mused Mostar, who squatted next to Pal. Together they were examining a little wild sprout with round green leaves. And tomatoes? She pointed to a 3-inch thread with 2 tiny narrow leaves. This one, I think. How many times do we cut off the bruised parts? I do that all the time, said Carmen, with more energy and excitement than I'd ever seen. The extra slices of something or cutting out pits. And salsa. This was directed down to Pal. When we have taco night, all the leftover salsa we make, right in the bin. Our own tomatoes. Even now I can't stop thinking how good they might taste. Mostar looked at Pal, who was gently brushing her fingertips across the wobbling tomato stalk. You know, we still have a lot of older soil-type compost. That has to have more seeds. And rice! I pointed to the little square foot where I'd sprinkled Bobby's brown rice. It was now a solid patch of grass. Rice! Mostar beamed at me. I explained where I'd gotten it and how much more I thought Bobby had left. Mostar's lips rounded into a tight O. We can live on that. Rice and beans. She looked at Carmen. Do you have any more of those bean bags lying around? We might. Carmen looked at Pal. And maybe some extra loose beans we didn't use. Maybe in the arts and crafts chest? Pal nodded enthusiastically. Then that would be worth it. Mostar nodded back. Worth the calories to build more gardens. More gardens? Dan almost hit the ceiling. Totally! Another garage! Maybe 2! Drip lines! Compost! He glanced at Palomino. More worms and shit! And shit? Mostar asked with cocked eyebrow. Dan laughed. His cheeks reddened. Yes! Really! The biodigester tanks! And to me, with outstretched palms, come on! I won't get cut or sick, I promise! Before I could answer, Carmen asked me, can we do it? I wasn't sure if she was asking for my permission or expertise. Not that I had either to give, but Dan, Carmen, Palomino, the way they were all looking at me. And Mostar hanging back, crossed arms, judging my call. My mind had already been racing through calculations, judging if the math added up. 1 cup of brown rice was around 200 calories. 1 cup of beans, depending on type, might be the same or more. And fattening, too. Most beans had fat in them, about 1 gram per cup. But how many cups of beans and rice could we hope for? We can, I started to say, but held out my hands quickly. But after we finish the perimeter, first things first, right? Safety, then food. Soon as we get the stakes up, soon as we know they work, we'll focus on more gardens. Yeah! Dan pumped his fist as Carmen hugged her daughter. Behind them, Mostar smiled and nodded. I felt 10 feet tall. Then she jerked her head to the door and tapped her wrist like an old-style wristwatch. Reinhardt! My shift! I ran over to Reinhardt's house and saw through the window that Effie was reading in the chair next to his couch. She saw me, smiled, and got up to join me in the foyer. I could see Reinhardt was sleeping, and she said that he'd been out for most of the morning. I tried to apologize for being late and described what had happened in the garden. She brightened, but not for the reason you'd think.
Thank you, she said. Thank you for all you're doing with Palomino. She needs the purpose now. Routine.
She looked across the circle to her house, where her wife and daughter were waving from the window. And now, her eyes scanned the ridge. She needs to focus on something positive. We all do. More waves from her family, and a final thank you before heading home. So many thoughts were racing through my head. How many gardens can we build? And what about this one? What now? How much warmth do those little plants need? Dan had been right about cleaning off the roof. We'd need every kilowatt to keep the garage at summer temperatures. And what about summer light? Happy lamps? Everyone has one. Enough? At least the walls are white. Reflective. Aluminum foil? That hydroponics store in Venice. A plant in a reflective box? And fertilizer. Can we really use our own poo? Safe for Dan? Worth it? Smelling up the house? So many questions, sitting here writing all this down. Foggy brain. Should nap. Reinhardt's still out. But his library. So many books. Gotta be something useful. Journal entry number 14 continued. Nope, there wasn't. Not one practical text, and believe me, I looked. Lots of philosophers, though. Descartes, Voltaire, Sartre, and shelves of historians like Gibbon, Keegan, and Tacitus. Beautiful novels, too, leather-bound first editions with gold-printed names like Proust, Zola, and Molière. And, of course, there are his books. Halfway to Marx, Walking with Xu Xing, and the famous Rousseau's Children, in at least a dozen languages, French, Italian, Greek, Chinese, or Japanese, I can't tell. Can't be Korean because I didn't see those little circles. I noticed a lot of Rousseau's works were intermixed with various volumes of his book, as if they were buddies who got published at the same time. At one point, I thought I'd hit pay dirt when, going through the larger coffee table books, I came across the title Vanishing Cultures of Southern Africa. I thought I might at least get some helpful tips from the pictures. I didn't. It turned out just to be white man's porn. A lot of voluptuous, topless, or totally naked women dancing and jiggling in various indigenous ceremonies. Okay, so maybe these are culturally accurate photos, and maybe I'm projecting too much from memories of my colonialism and male sexuality class at Penn. But Reinhardt's the exact age to have collected National Geographic the way later generations read Playboy for the articles. And besides, the picture on the spine above the title should have been a giveaway. It showed a beaded G-string between a woman's legs. There was one section, though, which I almost missed. It was of a young woman during a coming-of-age ceremony carrying what looked like a hybrid sword/spear. I say hybrid because the shaft was shorter than I'd ever seen, barely 3 feet, while the blade was longer, about a foot and a half. The caption underneath described the weapon as an ikwa, which made me skip to the index for a closer look. It's a Zulu weapon, invented by a guy named Shaka, which revolutionized Bantu warfare. Unlike earlier throwing spears, which could be knocked away by the other side's shield, the ikwa was meant for close combat. The wielder would get right up into the face of his enemy, knock the shield away with his own, then stab the short spear's long blade under the man's armpit. That's where the name comes from. The sucking sound of pulling it out of the dead man's heart and lungs. Ikwa. Gross? Yes. And horrifying to think of whole armies fighting this way. But I couldn't help being fascinated by the book's comparison to Roman legionnaires who fought in a similar way.
different places, different ages, completely different cultures, and yet they came up with similar weapons and tactics. Is there something about how we're wired, something universally human? That was my last fuzzy thought before I finally nodded off. The comfortable chair, Reinhardt's rhythmic breathing. I didn't know what happened until my head suddenly jerked up to a dark sky with Reinhardt coming out of the entryway bathroom. Must have been the flushing that woke me. After half a couple disoriented seconds, I realized that Reinhardt was supporting himself against the wall. I jumped up to help him, but he waved me away with, "I'm okay. I'm okay." He clearly wasn't. Even as I struggled to get him back onto the couch, I could see how pale his lips were. I asked if he was hungry, and he nodded weakly. I remember thinking, that must be a good thing. Don't really sick people lose their appetites? There wasn't much, at least when it came to frozen diet meals, but I did find plenty of secret goodies, little packets of gummies and candies squirreled away. He must have hidden them all upstairs, like the ice cream, when I came over to catalog his food. Now they were everywhere, stuffed into drawers and cabinets all over the kitchen. It actually gave me a little bit of sympathy to see all those caches. I'd hid more than a few Twix bites from Mom. Shame. I didn't feel too sorry for him, though. Not when I asked if there was anything he could and couldn't eat in his condition. I got a feeble, "Anything is fine, I guess." "You guess? Aren't you supposed to know if you have a heart condition? Lord knows his library isn't much help." "Hey, Flaubert, what can't a heart attack victim eat?" I settled on his second-to-last packet of Insta-waffle, the kind you eat from a cup, just add water, stir, and nuke. I tried not to keep reflexively checking the windows or note that there were no kitchen knives to be seen. The man has probably never cooked anything in his life or has had people do it for him. Amazing how your perception of a space can change so quickly. If I'd been invited into Reinhardt's kitchen 2 weeks ago, I might have just thought about the decor, or lack thereof. Then, when I came in with Dan a few days ago, all I could think about was what there was to eat. Now all I could think about was what I could use to defend myself. Same room, different priorities. The microwave chirped, and I stuck a spoon in the expanded muffin-looking thing. Reinhardt was sitting up now and swallowing with obvious delight. "No sugar?" I told him it looked like it already had plenty, but his, "Aw, come on," shrug sent me back to the kitchen. "Some salt, too," I heard him call from the living room, with what sounded like a full mouth. And then, after probably realizing his tone, he added, "Please." I grabbed the salt shaker off the counter, the box of white sugar from the pantry, and returned to discover that he'd practically finished. The world-famous scholar looked up at me like a 10-year-old boy. Couldn't wait. Something rattled. I jumped and spun. My eyes flicked to the source of the noise. It was the kitchen door, the cracked glass rattling in its fixture. Reinhardt said, "It's been doing that. The wind." I apologized, told him that Dan would be happy to look at it, and felt my body relax. That was when the yawn came out, big and loud, and I covered my mouth with embarrassment. As my eyes opened, I saw Reinhardt looking at me with an expression I hadn't recognized before, a kind, almost fatherly smile. He said, "I'm the one who's sorry. I shouldn't have kept you here to watch me. You've got to get home and to bed." I told him that I was fine, to which he responded, "Balderdash," and asked how many hours I'd slept in the last 2 days. I confessed to a couple of catnaps. Aha! A tiny twinkle, a wag of the finger, and a dramatic two-hand sweep toward the door. "Do you want me to set the alarm?" Then, remembering all the window damage, said, "At least the internal sensors? Maybe just the kitchen." "What if I need a midnight snack?" He patted his stomach lightly. "You think I know how to disarm that infernal apparatus?" "But you can't make it to the kitchen," I protested. "If you get dizzy, fall, and hit your head or something." "Go, go. I think it was a..." He hesitated before saying, "Nerves. I used to get, when I was young, these spells. I could have been more forthright last night." He scowled at the floor. "It's a cruel joke, those formative years when your brain learns the rules of the universe. Your childhood is spent being nurtured, protected, loved unconditionally, while your adulthood is spent searching in vain for substitutes. Mate, government, God." He suddenly looked up at me, embarrassed, angry. "Sorry." He waved his hand like those words had been a bad smell. "Intellectual coward." I felt so bad for him, all that puffed up veneer stripped away. Embarrassed old man, admitting his weakness. All I could say was, "It's all right. I mean, who doesn't want to be taken care of when things get scary?" He repeated that phrase, "taken care of," and blinked hard with a long, wet sniff. I suddenly found myself asking, "Do you want to stay at our place? You know, just in case it isn't a panic attack, if you need something in the middle of the night?" He paused at that, genuinely surprised, then said with a smiling swat, "Will you get out of here already?" "Just let me clean up first," I said, and carried his cup and spoon to the kitchen. It didn't take long. Spoon in the dishwasher, disposable cup in the trash. But when I came back, he'd already managed a trip to the bookshelf. 3 small, thick, red hardbacks were sitting on his lap. I'd noticed them before, but couldn't read the Latin titles. "Childhood friends," he said. "Cato, Vero, Columella, their writings on agriculture." And of my questioning look, he answered, "I overheard you telling Effie about the sprouts. I wasn't really asleep." He opened the first book, grabbed his glasses off the table, and said, "Maybe I can find something useful in here." Then, with a derisive snort, added, "Maybe I can be useful for once." And with a really bitter chuckle, he muttered, "Work sets you free." Where have I heard that before? I told him not to stay up too late. He said, I won't, and shooed me away with a smile and a big yawn. That was about an hour ago. I'm home now in my kitchen, writing all this down before getting back to work. Dan's on the floor, sitting cross-legged amidst a pile of bamboo. 2 piles, actually. A smaller one of finished steaks and a much larger, rougher pile resting across his lap. He's out, by the way, back against the fridge, snoring, half buried in his bamboo blanket. I thought about waking him to go upstairs, but I know he'll just want to get back to work. I think I'll crash on the couch for a couple hours, set my phone for midnight. Then I'll get up, maybe wake Dan as well, and the two of us can saw spikes till morning. Mostar thinks we'll have enough by tomorrow night to completely ring the neighborhood. And after that, I keep getting up to check on the garden, to see how all my little sprouts are doing. They're so beautiful, so vulnerable. I gotta figure out the best way to raise them. Raise? Whatever, so tired. Tomorrow, or rather the day after tomorrow, after I get a really good night's sleep, after the perimeter is done. By that time, Reinhardt might have found some tips in his books. I hope he's okay. As I started to leave, back turned, my hand on the knob, he said, "Good night, Hannah."